My name is Allison Cato Jackson. I am 46 years old.
Today is
August 4th, 2019, and I'm speaking with Philip Cato, who is my father. We are recording this interview in Wolfboro, New Hampshire, by right outside of Lake Winnipesaukee. Okay, Dad, thank you for joining me for this interview.
Happy to be here.
And I wanted to start with your childhood. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Charlotte, North Carolina, in a small neighborhood on the north side of Charlotte, sort of, as we used to say, on the other side of the tracks. Three long streets side by side, and that was it. It was surrounded by other things, woods and businesses and things like that. And it was a very compact neighborhood, and all the children went to one school, Parks Hutchinson School, which only had six grades, and it was one room for each grade.
Oh, wow. Very good. And what are your memories of being a child during World War II?
Well, my most vivid memory about World War II, let me think. I must have been about 7 years old when we were sitting out on our front porch. We had a front porch overlooking the street. We were up above the street a little bit. And we used to sit out there to read the funny papers or the newspaper or whatever on Sunday afternoon. And my father heard on the radio that Pearl Harbor had been attacked. And after that, it was kind of Katie bar the door. Every day there were big headlines in the paper, but I distinctly remember his talking about Pearl Harbor being attacked.
Did that frighten you?
I didn't quite know what to think about it. First place, I didn't know where Pearl Harbor was. I knew we had been attacked by another country. Mm-hmm. It's hard to think through your adult thinking back to what it was like then. I don't recall being frightened or anything, but I knew it was a momentous thing.
Okay. And was your father, my grandfather, involved in the war effort?
He was in an interesting way. In his earlier life, he had been a member of the North Carolina National Guard. He was a lieutenant, first lieutenant in the North Carolina National Guard for a number of years, and he wanted to joined the Army as part of the war effort, but he was working in a fairly good-sized steel company, and they were called upon to make parts for ships, and so he was not allowed to go on active duty. He had to stay there and make steel parts for ships for the war.
What was the name of the steel company?
Southern Engineering Company.
Okay. And so...
And they called it Little Pittsburgh. It was a steel company. It was a steel fabrication company.
And his name was Thornwell, but people didn't call him that?
No, they called him Tony.
Tony.
Because his last name sounded Italian to them, I suppose it isn't, but that's what
Tony Cato.
Yeah, that's what they called him.
Okay.
Or some of his employees called him Thorn, in short, for Thornwell.
Because he could be a little thorny?
But only behind his back, never to his face.
Never to his face. Okay. And he really rose in the ranks at that steel company, didn't he? Yes, he did.
He started there in 1925 as just a laborer, and by the time I was in college, he was the vice president of operations of this company.
Wow, that's amazing.
But most of his life, he was the superintendent of the shop. That's what they called him. It was a very large area that they fabricated steel in, and he was in charge of all the workers and the work products and keeping things on time and making things happen.
Do you have a fond memory or a funny story about him?
Well, I don't know. Yeah, I do in a way. My father was a very quiet man, but he was also extremely strong. And when he first went to work there, he was just one of the guys working there. And there was a fitter named Mac McGinnis who was built like a fire plug. He was really strong, but shorter than my father. And when my father was made the superintendent of the shop, he told Mac to do something, and Mac... my father didn't tell me this. One of the other workers told me this story. My father, he told Mac to do something, and my father, he said no, or he wasn't going to do it. And my father stepped back and, with the back of his hand, slapped him off his feet.
Oh, my gosh.
And my his co-worker said to me, nobody ever questioned him after that.
I guess
not. The steel company was a very noisy place, you can imagine, with riveting and all kinds of things going on all the time. And this same worker told me that people there were so afraid of him that when he walked down through that noisy shop, you could hear the eyeballs click.
Jeez Louise. So, I mean, was your childhood a happy one?
I think so. My father worked extraordinarily long hours. I mean, he was gone 9-10 hours a day because the steel company was all the way across town, and they put in a really long day during the war. But I think I had a happy childhood.
You had polio, right, Dad?
In 1948.
What was that like?
When I was 14 years old.
Okay.
Well, it was really extraordinary. My father made a point of going to the funerals of all the people that were brought back from the Second World War. And the war was over, obviously, in 1945, but somebody's body was found somewhere. I don't know which theater of war, and was brought back for burial in 1948.
Okay.
And my parents went down to wherever this town was to attend the funeral of this worker of his and left us three children at home. I was 14, my older sister was 15, and my younger sister was 12. And during the time that they were gone, I got a terrific headache. And I've never had a headache, and to this day, I don't have headaches. I mean, it's just not part of my physiology. And it was just became almost unbearable. And of course, my older sister didn't know what to do.
Since
she didn't have any training or anything. Anyway, to make a long story short, they came back and we called a doctor. He was a brand new doctor, Bill Matthews, because our old family doctor had retired. And Bill Matthews came out to our house and he took one look at me and called an ambulance because there was a polio epidemic going on at the time.
Okay.
And he picked me up, literally, and carried me down the steps to the street to put me in the ambulance. I still remember that. I still remember that the ambulance was green and white. I don't know why I remember that, but I do. And I was taken to the hospital where a spinal tap revealed that I had polio.
Oh, wow.
And I was put in a polio ward for a number of, I don't recall how long I was there, but it was way too long.
Sure.
And I was in a room with two other men who were in much worse shape than I was in. I didn't have any paralysis, as it turned out. Once they got me, stood me up after I'd been lying there flat on my back for weeks. I couldn't walk, but I didn't have any paralysis. I just had tremendous muscle weakness in my back and in my legs.
I'm sure that took quite a bit to recover from that.
Took about a year.
Regain your strength.
I had to stay at home during much of that time. I missed some school, but anyway, I eventually got well enough to go back to school, and then they wouldn't let me take physical education because they thought it would make the polio recur.
Oh, geez.
And the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis came and checked me once a year to make sure how I was progressing.
And tell me about your mom, Edna.
Edna was a very delightful person. She had a lot of personality. She had friends. She used to go up the street to play cards with her lady friends. I guess we lived in a very small neighborhood. She loved reading, and she instilled reading in me. So
okay.
That I began reading at a very early age, and I don't recall how old I was, but I was way too young. I read The Brothers Karamazov by Dostoevsky.
Oh, goodness gracious. Okay, so that's where your reading came from.
Oh, yes.
That explains it.
Still read all the time now.
So speaking of that, what did you choose to study, and how did that all come to pass?
Well, it came to pass in a weird kind of way. I was thinking, I never talked to my parents. Neither of my parents had gone to college. I was going to go to some small school. We didn't have a lot of money. I was going to go to some small Methodist college a few miles from our house. But the director of Christian education at the Methodist church that we went to at the time said to me, no, you have to go to Duke. And I said, no, I can't go to Duke. And she said, you have to go to Duke. So I took the Andrew B. Duke scholarship exam. I did not get the award, but that helped me in my application.
Okay.
And Duke was the only school I applied to, and they admitted me. And in the back of my head, I didn't know what I was going to study. I had decided I was going to study medicine. So maybe it was because of the polio, who knows. And I went there, and I didn't get up early enough on the day you signed up for classes. When I went to sign for pre-med, all the classes were filled.
Oh.
Completely. So I had to decide something. And so I went to my secondary interest in life, and I just became an English major, and I just stayed there. I never changed it. So I was an English major, but I really just got a general liberal arts education.
Sure.
With a lot of English in it.
And Dad, didn't you run track at Duke?
I did. When I was a freshman, I had to take physical education, and I went through several different sports during that first semester. But at Duke, you had to earn a lifesaver achievement to graduate. And I.
You mean swimming?
Swimming.
Okay.
Swimming, lifesaving, yes. And so one of the things you had to do was dive within 3 feet of the edge of the pool. And as the class moved on, they left one coach there. He could not make me try to dive within 3 feet of the pool.
You weren't much of a swimmer.
I had visions of scraping the front end of me off.
Uh-huh.
So I heard by the grapevine that if you were on a sports team at Duke, you could get out of PE. You didn't have to take physical education. So I went to the track coach,
okay.
Red Lewis, who was the track coach, and I told Coach Lewis that I had polio and that I had a lot of weakness in my legs and hadn't learned to run properly any time in my life, and I asked him if he would help me learn to run.
Okay.
He said, pull a uniform and show up tomorrow afternoon. And so I did, and I became a long-distance runner for Duke. I ran cross-country in the 2 mile. Cross-country in the fall and the 2 mile and indoors in the winter on a wooden track, and 2 miles in the outdoors in the spring. So I ran 9 months a year.
I remember seeing a photo of you from that time, and you looked pretty fit, Dad.
I was pretty fit.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I had a great time.
And we haven't mentioned also... Well, you were in the choir as a young person too, didn't
yes.
you sing?
When I was very young, when I was like 9 years old, we had a traveling music teacher that came to our very small grammar school, and she got in touch with my mother and said that I had a very good boy soprano voice and it ought to be trained. Well, of course, we couldn't have a trainer, so we heard from somebody that William Wall Whitett was the greatest boy choir director and mankind or something, and he was at St. Peter's Episcopal Church. I belonged to the First Baptist Church, which was across the street from St. Peter's, so I had the best religious education in the world. I would go to Baptist Sunday school and learn everything in the world about the Bible, and then I would go across the street to the Episcopal Church, where I had the best liturgy in the world. And so I was a member of that boys' choir from the time that I was 9 until my voice changed when I was 4 years later. And so I sang in that choir with some interesting people. Among them were Jack and Will Spong, and Jack later became an Episcopal bishop and wrote a lot of books. Some people know his name, John Spong.
And what kind of impact did that have on you? Didn't you also, weren't you in some plays as well as you were older?
No, well, I was in a play in high school. I was one of the policemen in The Pirates of Penzance, which was a lot of fun. That was my only theater experience, but when I got to Duke, I got recruited for the theater company there, and I was Hortensio in The Taming of the Shrew, which was great fun. And then in 1976, when I was a clergyman, I was in Morristown, New Jersey at the Bicentennial, and the Broadway play 1776 was written in Morristown, actually right across the street from the church in the library by Sherman, and so... We decided, the community theater group decided to put on 1776 to celebrate the bicentennial, and I was selected to be John Adams. And so I was John Adams for 3 performances of 1776, which was a tremendous learning curve, because John Adams is on stage 90% of the time in that play with many lines and 6 or 7 songs. It was a lot of work, but that was my last theatrical experience.
Do you think somehow being in the Episcopal choir influenced your sort of choice towards becoming an Episcopal priest as opposed to a Methodist or other?
There's no question about that. My religious history is interesting. My father didn't go to church. My mother was a Baptist, and my 2 sisters and I were. And then somehow, one at a time, we migrated to the Methodist church.
Okay.
I don't know why. It was just right down the street. It was another block down the street. And it was a very large church. It took up a half. It was a city block long. So we went to that church until I was in high school and off to college. And so when I went off to college, I mean, of course, I had those 4 years experience of singing in the Episcopal Church. And then when I went off to college, I tried every religion known to mankind, literally, including Judaism. I even studied Hebrew and all this kind of stuff. I tried Catholicism. I tried everything. I spent a summer with the Quakers in Chicago working for the American Friends Service Committee between my sophomore and junior year. And then I discovered the Episcopal chaplain at Duke, whose name was Joe O'Brien, who was himself a former Baptist.
Oh my goodness.
And I love Joe O'Brien, and I got involved with the Episcopal group at Duke and went to they had services there. And then I got confirmed my senior year in college, and a few months after that was interviewed by the Suffragan Bishop of North Carolina for ordination, and got through that process and went off to school at the Episcopal Theological School in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
So it happened very soon, almost immediately after you graduated Duke, that you started that process?
Yeah, I started the process before I graduated.
Even before you graduated, okay.
Yeah, and then I was already what's called a postulant by the time I graduated, and then I went straight to seminary.
In Massachusetts. Okay.
Cambridge, Massachusetts, yes.
And that school is still?
That school is no longer in existence. It was a small Episcopal seminary attached to Harvard, and we were enrolled in both schools at the same time.
Okay.
You could take half your courses over in Harvard if you wanted to. We shared faculty and stuff like that, but it was a terrific experience.
It sounds wonderful. And how did you come to join the military? What was the timeline of that?
Well, I got out of seminary, and the bishop sent me to some little mill town in North Carolina for about a year and a half, and then I went to Charlotte, North Carolina to be a curate in a suburban, good-sized suburban parish, Holy Comforter in Charlotte. And while I was there, somebody, I to this day do not know who it was, somebody told me about a Naval Reserve unit that was active in the town, and I decided to go see about it. So I started attending their meetings. Even though I was not in the reserves, I became a part of the reserve unit, and they gave me a job within the unit and all this kind of stuff, even though I wasn't even an officer. And so I participated in that for a couple of years.
Okay.
And then I decided to apply for the reserves myself. And I started the process while I was still in Charlotte as a curate at Holy Comforter. And then I got called to be the Episcopal chaplain to North Carolina State University in Raleigh. And I moved to Raleigh. And about the time that I moved to Raleigh, just about when I moved, they called me in for my physical, which I took. And I passed it, and I got a direct commission as a lieutenant junior grade in the Naval Reserve. The Naval Reserve building was across the street from the back side of the campus. So it was convenient. I joined the reserves, and then I went to Newport, Rhode Island to chaplain school in the winter. Nearly froze myself to death. And then from then on, I just stayed in the reserves, and I ended up having a 30-year career in the reserves, ending up with the rank of captain. Well, I was a captain, actually, for one-third of my career. And toward the end of my career, my reserve duties found me working for active duty admirals. I worked for three vice admirals and two rear admirals on their staffs, and I was the force chaplain for the military Sealift Command, which took me around the world. So I had a very interesting and fun
Wonderful career.
And yeah. I was also at one time in charge of the Navy Chaplain History Project. I worked for the Chief of Chaplains as head of the Navy Chaplain History Project. I have a background in history of thought, as well as I have a PhD in intellectual history. So they let me be the head of the History Project.
Now, when did you meet Mom?
While I was in Charlotte.
Okay.
We were both doing youth work in the diocese, and there was a conference somewhere of all the youth groups around the diocese, and I met her there.
Okay, very good. So that was, you all lived in Raleigh together?
We did.
Okay.
And we were in Raleigh from the time I got married, which was 63, until I moved to Atlanta in 68 to be the chaplain to Georgia Tech.
Okay. And how was it that you ended up at Emory pursuing a doctoral degree?
Well, we had a professor that used to come over to our house just for social things, David Hessler, who had a University of Chicago PhD, and he worked for the Graduate Institute of the Liberal Arts at Emory University, which was an interdisciplinary graduate school. And I had developed an interest. I had quit reading. I read theology for years and years and years and years. I was theology examiner for the Diocese of North Carolina. I was very knowledgeable about theology. And then I woke up one day and I just kind of lost interest in it. I mean, I wasn't reading anything I didn't already know, and I got kind of tired of it. And so I dropped it for a while and started reading science instead, because I've always been interested in science. And then David Hussle was over at my house one night, and I had walked into a bookstore and found a little book on evolutionary theology that some German guy had written. And I just thought it was fascinating. So I said to Hessler, you know, everybody was against evolutionary theory in the church when it first appeared from Darwin, but then here is evolutionary theology. I'd like to know more about that. So can you tell me somebody I can go talk to over at your school to find out more about this? And he said, you're too undisciplined. You just read everything that you can get your hands on. He said, you need to be more focused. So why don't you enroll in our graduate institute? And I said, I'm not even thinking about doing that. Well, anyway, to make a long story short, I took the GREs, I passed them. And I had already done some graduate work at Duke earlier while I was chaplain at NC State in philosophical and historical theology. That's back when I was doing heavy theology. So then I applied, and they accepted me, to my great surprise, and I started doing coursework, and I was really not interested in getting a degree. I was just going to go to courses because I was learning so much, and it was wonderful. As an interdisciplinary school, we would have people from two or three different disciplines teaching each graduate seminar, so it was just enormously exciting to me. And I just took courses and took courses and took courses and took courses, and I walked in one day, and the secretary said, well, you finished your coursework, now it's time for your comps. And I was startled. But anyway, they wrote my comps, and somehow, by the grace of God, I passed them.
What year was that, Dad?
Let me think. I got my degree in 77. That was about 3 years after that. It was probably 73.
Mm-hmm. So you had four small children at home within 5 years apart of one another.
Listen, you won't believe this. Let me just give you this list.
Lay it out,
Dad. I don't know how I did it. I was the assistant rector at All Saints Atlanta, which meant that I preached there regularly, this very large suburban parish. I was the chaplain to Georgia Tech and Agnes Scott College. I was the reserve chaplain in the largest reserve center in the United States, which is on the Georgia Tech campus. Some other guy did the Marines, I did the Navy. I was a graduate student at Emory. I was a part-time teacher at Georgia Tech in the General Studies program, and we had four small children at home. I did all that at the same time, and to this day. And I served on the board of two organizations in town, one of them that worked with runaways or something. I mean, I don't know how I did all this, but I did.
And what did you end up focusing on for your dissertation?
Well, that's an interesting story. I'm still interested in evolutionary theology, and so I discovered that Stowe Persons, I think that's correct, wrote a book called Evolution in America, and I picked it up and started reading it, and he had a section on theology, and he mentioned everybody got about one paragraph, but one man got a page and a half, and his name was Joseph LeConte, and I hadn't any idea who Joseph LeConte was. So I decided to explore that, and I discovered that Joseph LeConte was a 19th century geologist who actually he began as a physician. He started teaching college, he didn't like it, so he went to medical school, physicians and surgeons at Columbia University, graduated with a medical degree in 1845, tried practicing medicine, didn't like it, went back to school at Harvard with his first cousin and studied under Louis Agassiz at Harvard and got the first graduate degree from Harvard. First PhD from Harvard, and he became a geologist.
Okay.
And after that, he and his brother both taught at the University of South Carolina until the Civil War broke out, and then the University of South Carolina dissolved after the war was over, and he didn't know what to do with himself, and because he was on the wrong side of the war, being from the South, he couldn't get a job back up east. And so Charles Dana, who wrote 3 years before the mast, wrote him and said, you know, nobody's going to hire you up here because you're a Southerner, and you're on the wrong side, but there is a new university being founded on the West Coast, and maybe you and your cousin would like to move out there. So he did, in fact, they went out, the two of them, and became two of the founding faculty of the University of California at Berkeley. and his cousin was twice the president of Berkeley University, of the University of California, Berkeley.
But
and
what,
Lecoq spent the rest of his life at Berkeley.
What kind of caught your interest? What about him?
The thing that caught my interest was that in the course of his all of this, he wrote a book. He was a polymath. He understood physiology, and he understood geology, and he had medicine, and this and that, and philosophy, and education. And he wrote a book called Evolution and Its Relation to Religious Thought.
Okay.
Which I read and was startled by, because I still remember reading it. I was doing research at the Library of Congress and staying at the College of Preachers behind Washington National Cathedral, and they had a garden. I was there by myself, the summer session. It was during the summer, and there weren't any classes going on at that time. And I was sitting out in that garden, and I was reading this book. I had gotten a reprint from New York. I had ordered a reprint from New York of Lecoq's book. And I started reading the book and noticing the structure of it. I've always noticed the logical structure of whatever I'm reading. And I looked at it, and I said to myself, right out loud, if this is what I think it is, there's going to be a thing at the end on theodicy. And I turned to the end, and there it was. And I said to myself, this is very familiar to me. And the reason it was very familiar to me is that I used to teach courses in the thought of Teilhard de Chardin. And Teilhard de Chardin wrote a book that was, in my view, at least logically and argument-wise, the exact same book. He had somehow gotten exposed to Lecoq, and it had stuck in his mind. Now, when Lecoq's book was published, it got very little notice in the United States, but it was heavily read in Europe. It was translated into French, it was translated into German, it was translated into other languages. And it's entirely possible that Chardin had, in his education, had read the book. But it was the same kind of argument that one finds in Chardin's The Phenomenon of Man. And I actually mentioned that toward the end of my dissertation. I said, I didn't know how to bring it up because it was so awkward. And Chardin is such a revered person, as he should be, brilliant thinker. And so I said near the end of my dissertation, if Teilhard de Chardin was unfamiliar with the writings of Joseph Lecoq, then Lecoq must be all the more admired for having anticipated the thought of one of the 20th century's most brilliant thinkers. I didn't know how to say it nicely. I did, however, go see the head of the Teilhard de Chardin Society, who was at a university near where I was working, and tell him that I thought we had a little borrowing problem here that didn't get footnoted. And I recall how red he got in the face.
So reconciling evolution with religion, is that an interest of yours? Or what for the non-trained listener,
let me say it very simply. In the 19th century, after evolutionary thought happened, I can't talk about Europe, but I know what happened in Europe, but let me just talk about the United States. In the United States, evolution was seen by biblical literalists as being an attack upon God.
Right.
An attack upon God as creator. And so clergy just railed against evolution.
Right.
However, at the same time, and I found them, he was just one guy, as I suspected, there were lots of people who thought that evolutionary thought and their ideas about creation were just fine.
You
could reconcile them. And so he was just an example of that. I mean, when I wrote about him, the title of my dissertation was The Evolutionary Theology of Joseph Lecoq. And so what I did was, he was just one example of a number of clergy in the United States. And that German book had mentioned that. That German book that I originally read that got me interested in this problem had said that in the American South and other places, there were people who reconciled evolutionary thought with theology. Didn't name them, but I decided I'd go find them.
Sure. And that's not the only time that your thinking has been a little more progressive than sort of the zeitgeist. I'm thinking of your involvement in the civil rights movement.
Oh, I don't know about that. You know, it's interesting. People have talked to me about that as I've grown up. I don't recall that as being a huge issue as I was growing up. I don't recall it as being an issue until I was in Duke. And when I was at Duke, I was the head of the North Carolina chapter, North Carolina, Virginia chapter of the National Student Association, which was considered to be later to be somewhat radical. But we had a conference at Duke where we invited people from all the colleges in North and South Carolina to come, and some of those were African-American people, and we were going to have it on the first floor of the Student Center at Duke, and the dean called me in. I was horrified to be called in by the dean, but he called me in. Dean Herring called me in and said, we're moving your conference to the second floor of the Student Center. And I said, why? And he said, well, in effect, what it was about was that he didn't want these African-American students on the first floor of the Student Center.
Okay.
And when I found that out, I was absolutely livid. I was furious. And that's the first time I remember being conscious of the race issue, because we didn't have very many black students at Duke. We may not have had any except a handful by the time I was a senior. So that was a new way of seeing things. Anyway, I got ordained. I had some African-American people at my school whom I liked very much. I went through clinical training at the Worcester State Hospital with one of them. Really liked this guy very much. And then my father had African-American people that worked for him in the steel company that he revered and treated like equals, and I always observed that. And my postman when I was growing up, Mr. Brooks, was a man I liked very much. He was African-American, and I used to sit and talk to Mr. Brooks when he would come to deliver the mail, and I discovered one day he had a master's degree in history, and I said,
my goodness,
what are you doing delivering
right,
mail?
Right.
Anyway, and Mr. Brooks used to write me notes on the back of my mother's letters to me when I was in college, so I had these good relationships, and I was brought up by African-American maids, by the way, who when I was a little kid. So I'd never thought about it all that much, but I had these relationships. So I got to my second job, which was the Holy Comforter in Charlotte, and I was new in the diocese. I was young,
sure.
Very young. I was probably about 24, 25 years old, something like that. And an announcement was made that came to all the churches that we were going to have a no music Sunday in the Episcopal Diocese of North and South Carolina. That was five Episcopal dioceses.
Huge.
And we were all supposed to figure out some way to have worship without music so that all of our music directors and organists and people could go to a big liturgical conference, which was going to be run by Massey Shepherd, who was the great scholar of the prayer book. And he taught at the Church Divinity School of the Pacific in Berkeley, California.
Wow.
And so it was, I was excited about
sure.
Massey Shepherd
right
even
up your
coming,
alley.
Even though I wasn't going to the conference. Anyway, they said it was going to be at the Myrtle Beach Country Club.
Uh-oh.
Well, I didn't say, I saw it, and I thought about it for a minute or two, and then I said to myself, the Myrtle Beach Country Club. So I called the two clergy. I called one of the clergy who was planning the conference. He had been my mentor when I was a deacon.
Mm-hmm.
And I really liked him. I admired him immensely. In fact, he later became an Episcopal bishop. And I said, Kelly Whitaker. And I said, Kelly? I just called him on the telephone. I said, Kelly, I got this notice about this conference, and it's at the Myrtle Beach Country Club. And I said, I think probably you know as well as I know that we have a lot of black churches
right.
in both North and South Carolina in the Episcopal Church, even though they're separate churches, they're black churches. And I said, they can't come to this conference because
mm-hmm.
they won't be allowed in the Myrtle Beach Country Club. And he said to me, Philip, you are very bright, a very promising young clergyman, and I'm sure you're going to have a terrific career. Why don't you just learn to mind your own business? And I put the phone down, and I was floored. First, I was floored that he said that, but I didn't know what to do. The other one was Charles Green, and he lived in Pittsburgh, North Carolina, which was about 60 or 70 miles away, maybe more than that. And so I knew Charles, and Charles was also an enormously talented musical person, and a very fine priest. He was the Episcopal Church in Pittsburgh. So I drove there. I got in my car and drove over there. And I walked in and I said, Charles, what are you thinking? You and Kelly have planned this conference. It's at this country club, and nobody who belongs to any black Episcopal Church can come to this thing. You know that as well as I do. There wouldn't be allowed in the place. He said to me, Philip, you are very bright, promising young clergyman, and why don't you learn to mind your own business? Which I could clearly tell they had been talking to one another.
Right. Sounded familiar.
So I went back to Charlotte, sitting in my little office, since I was the low man on the totem pole, I had a very little office, sitting in my little office, fuming. So I just pulled out a piece of paper and wrote Massey Shepherd. I've never met Massey Shepherd. I was in awe of him. But I got his address, and I wrote him, and I said, Dear Dr. Shepherd,
and I spelled out what was going on and told him what had been said to me. And I said, this is wrong. We cannot, the church cannot have conferences to which some of its members are excluded. I wish you would not even come to this conference. I said, in fact, and I remember my last sentence, I implore you in the name of Jesus Christ not to come to this conference, and sign my little name. He didn't know me from Adam's house cat. So about a week later, I heard the conference had been canceled.
Oh my goodness,
and
Dad.
And Massey Shepherd wrote me a nice note and thanked me for letting him know. And he pulled out of the thing. The whole thing collapsed. Five dioceses that had been planning to have a no music Sunday collapsed. So I knew I was in hot water at that point. Nobody said anything to me locally, but I was sitting there in my office one day and there was a knock at the door. And I went to the door and it was the bishop.
Uh-oh.
And he came in. He was a sweet guy. I love this man. He put me through school. He came in and he sat down and he looked at me. Had a very peculiar way of speaking. He said, Bishop Baker. He said, Phil? I said, yes, Bishop. He said, are you planning to come to the diocesan convention next week up there near Raleigh? And I said, yes, Bishop, of course I'm coming. He said, mm-hmm. He said, would you do me a favor? And I said, yes, sir. He said, would you keep your big mouth shut?
Oh, no.
And I said, yes, sir. He said, thank you very much. He just got up and put his hat on and left. That was our entire conversation. So I went to the conference. I went to the convention, the diocesan convention. Nobody spoke to me.
Oh, wow.
So I was getting a little heat. And that was the first thing I ever really did that had anything to do with civil rights. And then after that, I was in marches and did this and that and the other and went to court with some people. I went down one time and took communion to a bunch of my New England schoolmates who got thrown in jail down in Eastern North Carolina. I took communion to them and had to talk my way into this jail in order to do that. And I did a lot of stuff like that. And then I moved to Atlanta, and civil rights stuff was going on then. I don't recall doing a lot in Atlanta. I was brand new there. And the year that I moved there was the year that Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated. And so I moved there in January, and I think he was assassinated in April or
my
something
goodness.
Like that. So I thought it was my duty to go to his funeral, so I did. I went down and stood outside the Dexter Street, or not the Dexter Street, whatever that Baptist church was that his father was the minister of, mm-hmm. where his funeral was. Mm-hmm. You couldn't get in the church.
No.
So there were lots of people outside, and I stood outside. It was a bright, sunny day. And then they brought the casket out and put it on a wagon that was pulled by some mules, and he and Ralph Abernathy and all these people were walking alongside him. And we followed the casket across Atlanta. It was about 3 or 4 miles all the way across Atlanta to Morehouse College, where he was initially interred before they built a place for as a memorial to him. And I remember when we passed the State House, Lester Maddox, who was a great segregationist governor of Georgia, had sharpshooters standing on top of the State House in case, I guess, we attacked the State House or something, which is ridiculous. But I walked in that thing, and then you know, there was a few other things I did, but I didn't have any heroic role in the civil rights movement. That was about it.
But one of the things I admire about you, Dad, is you have the courage of your convictions. I mean, conceivably, you could have been in a lot of trouble for doing what you did.
I preached a lot of sermons about it. Oh, my goodness. I didn't mention that. When I was at North Carolina State University and at Georgia Tech, I preached a lot of sermons about that kind of stuff. But other than that, I didn't do anything. I mean, I didn't go on the Freedom Rides or anything like that. I didn't go to Mississippi or Alabama.
Dad, you're kind of known when you give a sermon for clutching your Bible and standing without any notes in front of you and just speaking forth. Can you mention a minute about sort of your approach to sermons?
Oh, let me tell you how that happened. My last Sunday in Atlanta at All Saints, this big parish, big downtown parish, we had a woman who was kind of one of the matriarchs of the parish, Mrs. Stern. Mrs. Stern was the mother of people who did important things in Atlanta. And she was quite elderly. And as I was leaving my last Sunday, I came down and she was standing there leaning on her cane, and she walked up to me and she said, Mr. Cato. And I said, yes, ma'am. Yes, Ms. Stern. She said, I have something to say to you. And I said, okay. She said, you'd be a pretty good preacher if you get rid of that damn manuscript. And I was floored that she had used the word damn. But I took that to heart. Then I moved to Morristown, New Jersey, to another very large parish in Morristown, New Jersey, St. Peter's. And I had been there a while, and Betty Noling.
I remember Miss Betty.
Betty Noling walked up to me. She was the drama teacher at the Far Hills Country Day School. She said to me, "You'd be a pretty good preacher if you get rid of that damn manuscript." And I couldn't believe she had said the same thing Miss Stern had said. So anyway, Betty Noling came up to me just before I was leaving on vacation to go down to Pawleys Island. We were going down to Pawleys Island. And she handed me a little paperback book, and she said, "I want you to take this on vacation with you and memorize it." And I said, "What is it?" She said, it's the script for 1776. And I said, what are you giving this to me for?" And she said, "Because you're going to be John Adams in 1776. And I said, "No, I'm not." She said, "Oh, yes, you are." So anyway, to make a long story short, I had mentioned earlier that I was John Adams in 1776. We did three performances. And when that was all over, and I'd been on stage for almost 2 hours each one of those times, Noling walks up to me and says, "Okay, if you can do that, you can preach sermons without a manuscript." And I haven't used one since.
And you do have the gift of the way that you speak when I'm
very clear.
Yes. And you taught me that when I had to give a speech
I never hesitate. I never repeat myself. And I'm very logical. I have a logic teaching style. Yeah.
So, Dad, I remember very clearly you coming to Lakeland, Florida, where I lived at the time, and you were up, I guess you were in D.C., but you flew down to Florida to help me get ready to give my own speech for the first time in front of a large group of people.
Mm-hmm. Well, I had been training lay readers for years, so I know how to coach people about speeches.
Apparently, I did not have very good diction at that time, so you helped me slow down and enunciate for my high school.
Enunciation is everything.
High school speech, so I really appreciate that. From the time I was about three until now, you've always lived apart from me, but we've remained incredibly close. And I have all these memories of flying in the clouds to go see Dad. Mm-hmm. But I have to tell you, one time that was really hard for me to fly up to see you was when you had a heart attack at home. And I remember getting the call from Sarah, your lovely wife, who has been a part of my life for many, many years. And she said, "I don't know if Dad's going to make it. He had a heart attack at home." And I gave him CPR. And then our neighbor, who was a pilot, gave him CPR until he could be
transported
to the hospital. And he's in a coma. Will you please come up to see him? And by some sort of miracle, you survived all of that. What is your first memory of waking up from the coma?
Well, it's very vague, but I remember the neurologist or somebody came in to see me, and I think I remember this. I mean, all I remember is some doctor type person said to me, my family were standing around, and he said, "Who is this?" And I said, "My daughter." "Who is this?" "My son." "Who is this?" "My daughter." And he said, "And who is this?" My wife was standing on the left of the bed, and I said, "This is my beautiful wife."
And I remember you were so... You kept saying, "Isn't she pretty?" Dad, you were pretty funny. You were kind of, I'm going to be honest with you, Dad. You were speaking clearly enough, but you weren't 100% yourself.
No.
And in fact, you were this very sweet, sweet version of yourself. And frankly, we were all a little worried because you, first of all, yes, you were very effusive about how beautiful Sarah is, which she is a very beautiful woman. You were so sweet to all the nurses. And I thought, where is my grumpy dad? I don't need him to be quite this syrupy sweet.
Yeah,
So I think it was the first night that I came down. It was already, everybody was exhausted who had been around you right since it all started. And you were still in the ICU. And I decided to spend the night in your room because you were really starting to wake up. And I was just worried about what if you needed to use the bathroom or something in the middle of the night, and I would alert the nurses.
You were also a neuropsychologist, and you were worried about my mental state.
Okay, maybe that too. So, and this was probably my way of kind of checking in with your mental state, but because you were still having a hard time remembering kind of where I lived, and you knew who I was, but maybe not who my husband was, or that I had two children, so it was all a little dicey. But the moment that I stopped